When I was a boy growing up in rural middle Tennessee, we had three television stations, and we had a black and white television. Saturday afternoons were always spent the same way for me because there were a series of programs on Saturday afternoons that I watched religiously. They were all country music programs. It was the Wilburn Brothers, Porter Wagoner. I remember when his girl singer, Norma Jean, left and he got a new girl singer named Dolly. Yeah, I'm that old. Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, who I think helped cultivate my love of bluegrass along the way. And every Saturday afternoon, I would be watching this whole sequence of programs. Now, often they would have a country comedian on one of those programs. Probably the most famous was the character created by Miss Sarah Cannon, Minnie Pearl. But there were others, and one of my favorites was a guy named Archie Campbell. Archie would tell fairy tales in a kind of mixed-up fashion on occasion, but he had one routine that I especially liked. He had a straight man who would always play off of him, but he would start to tell a story. He would begin by saying, "Well, you know, my uncle died." And the straight man would say, "Oh, that's bad." He said, "No, that's good. He left me $50,000. The straight man would say, "Oh, that's good." He said, "No, that's bad. By the time I paid taxes, I only had $25,000 left." He said, "Oh, that's bad." He said, "No, that's good, because I was able to have enough to buy me an airplane." He said, "Oh, that's good." He said, "No, that's bad, because I learned to fly. I was flying upside down, and I fell out." He said, oh, that's bad. He said, "No, that's good. I fell out over a big haystack." He said, "Well, that's good." He said, "No, that's bad. There was a pitchfork in the haystack." He said, "Oh, that's bad." He said, "No, that's good, because I missed the pitchfork." He said, "That's good." He said, "No, that's bad. I missed the haystack, too." And he would go on and on and on. And everything that appeared to be favorable was unfavorable. And everything that appeared to be unfavorable was favorable. And I think I loved it in part, not just because it was funny, but because it was so true to life. When things happen to us, we don't know the ultimate consequence of that. You know, we don't know whether it's going to be really good or really bad in the long run. And to listen to the psalm you just heard and took part in, you would think that for those who follow the God of Israel, nothing bad would ever happen. You can step on snakes, you can confront lions, you'll be protected, nothing bad will ever happen to you, except we know that wasn't true for the patriarchs and the matriarchs of Israel. It certainly wasn't true for Jesus. The Romans did the absolute worst they could think up to do to another human being, to Jesus. And we say, "Oh, that's bad." And yet God looked at it, and God, out of that cruelty and death, brought life. And God said, "Oh, that's good." So how are we to take this passage? Does God have our best interest at heart? A number of years ago, a church member and a friend emailed me. She said, "If we don't believe that God is a kind of puppet master directing everything we do and every move we make," which we don't, okay? We are not Calvinists, we United Methodists, we are Arminian, and we believe there is free choice, and we believe God gives us the freedom to make choices. She said, "If God isn't a puppet master directing every move that we make, then does God know what's going to happen in the future before it happens?" Well, I wrote back, and in a rare moment of honesty, said, "You know, it'd be presumptuous of me to try to figure out what God knows and what God doesn't know, but I have an assumption that I always work on, that God knows more than we think God knows, and God knows more than our limited imagination can even begin to fathom." Because when we ask that question, does God know what's going to happen before it happens, we tend to think of a kind of linear, choice-by-choice line in life where God knows the next choice you're going to make and the next choice and the next choice and the consequences of that. But what if, Over the years, I've come to a different understanding. What if God's imagination is so large and so great? And believe me, it's much larger and greater than this. But what if it's at least this large and great, that God can imagine every choice that every human being could ever possibly make? Because God knows our secret hearts, right? In ways that we can never know, even about ourselves. What if God knows every single choice that every single human being could possibly make, and every single consequence of every single choice that every human being could possibly make? And even more than that, and each time we make a choice, God works somehow in our lives saying, I'll work with that. I'll work with that. Yeah, I can work with that. I still don't understand how all that works. The way God is involved with and intertwined with our lives is a mystery. But I do believe that God is involved and intertwined in our lives. And I do believe that no matter what choices we make, even the most difficult, terrible things that we choose to do, or that others choose to do to us, or that simply happen to us, God can intervene in some way, and with our help, we bring something healthy and wholesome out of that. And I don't understand how that occurs exactly, but I do believe that God has our best interest at heart, no matter what the circumstances of our lives. Let me tell you a story. Recently, I've been reading a book that I've intended to read for a long time. I've heard about it for a long time. It's a book by a man named W.E.B. Du Bois. He wrote it in 1903. It's called The Souls of Black Folk. W.E.B. Du Bois went to school at Fisk University, was the first African American to receive a Ph.D. from Harvard University, taught for a number of years, was part of the founding of the NAACP. And this book, The Souls of Black Folk, written at the beginning of the 20th century, was probably one of the most prescient books ever written. He said that the problem of the 20th century would be the color line. And it was, if you recall. And it still is, if you're paying attention. In that book, he has a chapter devoted to an individual. An individual who made a huge difference and had a profound effect on the 1800s in this country and a particular religious tradition in this country. His name was Alexander Crummell. Ever heard of him? I hadn't. And I'm ashamed and astounded that I hadn't. He was born at the beginning of the 19th century. He was born of a free woman of color in New York City, and a former slave. He was sent to various schools, and in one of those schools he was sent to, when the neighbors found out there was a person of African descent attending that school, they threatened to tear the school down and to burn it down, so he had to leave. Well, that's a bad thing, right? Oh, no, that's good, because you see, he later went to a school in upstate New York called the Oneida School, which was originally for Native American students, but as an African American, he got a wonderful education there. He felt called to the priesthood. He was Episcopalian. He went to General Theological Seminary, and though he had great preparation, wonderful academic records, terrific grades, they said, we can't admit you because of the color of your skin, which is a bad thing. Except he went to Boston, a free city in Massachusetts, and he found a way to pursue ordination to the priesthood in the Episcopal Church in Boston. So he was ordained a priest. He got his own church. That's a good thing, right? Well, not so much because the church didn't flourish. Not the way he wanted it to. There wasn't a significant free African-American population for him to draw upon. So he decided that he would go to the Bishop of Philadelphia and ask if he could come and serve a church in Philadelphia. He went to the bishop, and the bishop said, sure, you can serve a church in Philadelphia, but don't ever expect to sit in on our convention our diocesan convention, and don't ever expect an African-American church to be represented there. And Alexander Crummell said, I cannot come to your diocese under those conditions. That was pretty bad, wasn't it? Well, not necessarily, because he went to England to raise money for a small congregation that he was serving. And while he was in England, he came to the attention of a number of abolitionists, including William Wilberforce. And during that time, they got him enrolled into Queen's College, Cambridge. He became the first African American to graduate from Queen's College, Cambridge. By this time, his calling was taking him in a different direction. And so when he finished his degree, he went to Liberia, where he was a priest and he was a professor. And he stayed there for 20 years before he came back to found a church in Washington, D.C., and served that church as its priest basically for the rest of his life. Now, during that same period that all of this was happening, the Episcopal Church was having conversations, just like other churches, about slavery and what they were to do about slavery. Would they divide like the Baptists and the Methodists did? Or would they stay together? During that time, he formed an organization of people of color within the Episcopal Church who were in ministry in any way. And I don't know, I don't have direct evidence that this affected the decision of the Episcopal Church to stay together instead of break apart, but I can't help but think that it had a positive effect. Now, if you look at the life of Alexander Crummell, you could say that God didn't necessarily have his best interest at heart. He had roadblock after roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. Actually, Du Bois says he met with three major temptations. You know, today's reading in the gospel is the story of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. And even though he doesn't directly address that, I think probably Du Bois had that story in mind when he said that Crummell faced three temptations. The first was the temptation to hate. His father told him stories about what it was like to be a slave. His father had been captured in Africa, brought to this country as a slave, and gained his freedom only later. He could have chosen to hate white people, but he resisted that temptation. Du Bois said he could have chosen despair when he faced roadblock after roadblock after roadblock to the calling that he had been called to and felt deeply he had been called to be a priest. And when seminaries and bishops rejected him, he could have given in to despair, but he resisted that temptation. And he could have given in to doubt. He could have even doubted that he was called to be a priest. He could have decided that this calling is just my imagination if so many people don't want me to be, but he did not give in to that temptation. And because he didn't, he had a profound effect on 19th century religious history in the U.S. and had a profound effect on W.B. Du Bois, who had a profound effect on 20th century religious history and sociology. So, did God have Alexander Crummell's best interest at heart? I think we asked the question the wrong way. The way we tend to ask it is we ask, does God have my self-interest at heart? Will God give me whatever I want? God certainly did not allow that in Alexander Crummell's life. He did not get everything he wanted. But if you ask the question differently, does God have our self-interest at heart? I think the answer is yes. In some mysterious way, God works through lives with all the adversities and all the difficulties, with all the things that appear to be bad and all the things that appear to be good that may turn out to be just the opposite. And in working through all of those lives, God has our self-interest at heart, even if my self-interest is not served. God has our best interest at heart. Not just for one group, but for everyone, for the entire universe. So as we work through this life with all of it, its adversities, and as we decide what's good and what's bad, remember that God is present in some mysterious way, working in and through all of our choices and all of those consequences, saying, I can work with that. I can work with that. And the question is, are we willing to work with God so that not just my, but that our best interests can be served?